This week on Making Contact. A growing movement is demanding the United States do away with the death penalty. In 2012, voters had the chance to replace California's death penalty with life without the possibility of parole. But while some saw the ballot measure as a way to end the death penalty, others saw life without parole as another kind of death sentence.
All revenge sentencing, 250 to life, 100 to life, the death penalty. You either believe in redemption or you don't.
On this edition, reporter Nancy Mullane speaks to some of those on California's death row, and we hear from two opponents of the death penalty about where the movement to end executions goes next. I'm George Lavender, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Across America, thousands of people are on death row. In California alone, several hundred people are housed in San Quentin State Prison, sentenced to die by lethal injection. A ballot initiative in November 2012 would have replaced their death sentences with life without the possibility of parole. Proposition 34 failed to pass, but not before sparking a renewed debate, both inside and outside death row, about the death penalty and what should replace it. With the increasing use of life without parole across the US, it's a debate that has wider implications, but the voices of those who have the most to lose from its outcome are rarely heard. Getting permission to interview people on death row is not easy, but KLW's Nancy Mullane went inside all three of San Quentin's death rows before the 2012 vote to find out what life was like inside and to ask them what they thought of the ballot initiative.
Before entering East Block, Public Information Officer Sam Robinson and I first have to pass through a walled sally port. Inside the entrance to the cell block, there's a large rotunda with high arched windows. Robinson leads me through two ancient-looking steel doors toward a set of black gates. An officer unlocks the gate to the left, and we head for the tiers of cells.
Afternoon, Lieutenant.
How you doing, brother?
Big man, big man.
There's quite a bit of razor wire here.
As we approach the cells, we pass a table piled with opened and unopened letters that have been sent to the inmates. Mail sent to prisoners is read and reviewed before it's delivered. A sign on the wall in large red print warns prisoners that feeding the birds will result in a CDC 116 or disciplinary write-up. There are no birdmen on death row. Robinson tells me all condemned inmates at San Quentin are evaluated and classified in one of two categories.
Here on death row, we house them as, we classify them as grade A and grade B. Grade A are individuals who are programming, who follow our rules for the most part. Grade B individuals are those who are the opposite of that, who are non-programmers, are gang affiliated or whatever the case may be.
Robinson says almost all inmates on East Block are grade A. As he talks, we make our way around the end of the block to see what looks like endless rows of cells. There are 57 on each tier, and the double-sided block is five tiers high, making a total of 509 cells. Looking down the first tier, a half-dozen wheelchairs are parked on the polished cement walkway, waiting.
East Block structurally mirrors the majority of our major housing units here at San Quentin, and that they're all five stories high, and those dimensions of those cells, they're all 4.5 by 10.
That means each cell is 48 square feet and 7 feet 7 inches tall, about the size of a walk-in closet. From inside their individual cells, the inmates can look out through a row of black bars, a sheet of perforated metal, a railing, and 40 feet of open space to a wall of windows that fill the cell block with natural light and air.
Here in East Block, these guys are confined to their cells for the most part of the day, with the exception of the 5 hours a day that they're allowed for recreation yard activities.
Pushed up against some of the cell doors are shoulder-high A-frame metal structures with telephones attached.
Because these guys can't exit their cells freely, we actually have a phone apparatus on wheels, as we say, and we push it in front of the individual cell. We leave his food port open. He's allowed to extend his hand out, grab the receiver, and place a call.
I ask Robinson if I can interview the inmates in their cells. He says I can interview any inmate willing to talk to me. I approach the cell of a middle-aged man named Walter Cook. In 1994, a jury convicted him of 3 counts of murder and sentenced him to death.
So you have a phone in front of your cell. Why?
do you make legal calls, talk to family, friends.
How often do you have access to the phone?
We get the phone like every other day, like once in the morning, once at night.
And how long have you been here?
What, 20 years?
20 years?
Yeah.
In this cell?
No, not in this cell, different cells.
But all here at Quentin?
Yep.
Uh-huh. And so you were sentenced in, what year would that be?
92.
92. Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Do you have family?
Yeah.
Yeah. You have children?
Yep.
How many?
Two.
How old are they?
20 and 21.
So do they come visit you?
Yep.
How often?
Probably like once every other week.
So you actually have contact?
Yep.
Oh, is that important to you?
Yeah, you know, you got to have contact with your family, or you have contact with your family, you don't have nothing.
Mm.
You know, that's something to keep your sanity. But we're not like people portray us on the movies are, you know, these crazy, deranged people, you know. I get the pressure from TV that everybody, you know, this child molester or rapist is not, you know, it seems like that's the stereotype that everybody here, that's what they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the people that's innocent, they feel, if you're here, you got to be guilty. That's not necessarily true.
Are you?
No, I'm not guilty.
You're not guilty.
I'm not guilty.
You're innocent.
Yeah.
You did not do it.
No.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Okay. So you have a good attorney?
Yep.
And you've been in here 20 years, so how far has your appeal gotten?
Still in state court. See, that's another thing that they get the misperception of, that we're delaying the process when it's the courts delaying the process. You know, they give the attorney generals them all these extensions. When you want to move your case forward, it's not on us. You know, they want to say, tell the public, oh, they're dragging their cases along. It's not us, it's the courts and the attorney general is dragging them along.
I see. So how has it changed, the time that you're doing a death sentence, from when you were sentenced to now?
There's more programs, you know, as far as like education. They got more mental health programs for the people who really do need it. And it's more cleaner in here than it used to be when they have birds flying around and big old rats and stuff.
We'll hear more of Nancy Mullane's report from Death Row later in the show. She was speaking with Death Row prisoners before the November 2012 vote on Proposition 34, which failed to pass. To put California's vote in context, we're joined now by two opponents of the death penalty. David Dow is the Cullen Professor at the University of Houston Law Center and a lawyer who has represented more than 100 people on death row. And Christine Thomas is a member of the campaign to end the death penalty. Her husband, Coral Thomas, is a prisoner on California's death row. David Dow, could you start by telling us who is on death row in America?
In the United States, the people who are more likely to be sentenced to death are people of color, people who have a victim who is a white person are dramatically more likely to be sentenced to death than people whose victim is a person of color. And most significantly of all, people who are sentenced to death are people who don't have the financial resources that allow them to hire a dream team of lawyers. There aren't rich people on death row, and the reason there aren't rich people on death row is not because rich people never commit crime, and it's not because rich people never commit murder. It's because the criminal justice system is a battle between opposing sides. It's a battle between the prosecutors and the defense lawyers. And it's not an even playing field. It will never be an even playing field. Wealthy defendants can come close to making it an even playing field. And defendants who are not wealthy cannot even come remotely close to making it an even playing field. And the proof of that is the population of people on death row.
Christine Thomas, remind us what California's Proposition 34 was about and why you opposed it.
We were asked if we wanted to repeal the death penalty, or the part of the death penalty called lethal injection, and replace it with a sentence of life without possibility of parole, which is already on the books in California as an alternate sentence to the death penalty. When trials happen, you're given that as an optional sentence for the same charge. And it failed by a small percentage of points, which I think was a surprise to a lot of people that were pro-death penalty. They didn't realize that the mood had changed that much. It wasn't a surprise to me, what I think that a lot of people might fail to realize that people that are actually staunchly against the death penalty didn't actually vote in favor of this because the sentence of life without possibility of parole, we feel, is actually a death sentence also. You leave prison dead. And there's a lot of people that have a moral problem with that, the revenge sentencing going on in this country. If you look at LWOP, the problem gets worse. If you look at that sentencing, people are even more likely to throw people away if they aren't executing them.
We'll hear more from David Dow and Christine Thomas later in the show, but we now return to California's death row at San Quentin State Prison. Speaking before the November 2012 vote on Proposition 34, reporter Nancy Mullane asks death row prisoner Walter Cook what he thinks of the ballot measure to replace the death penalty with life without the possibility of parole.
Really, it doesn't matter to me one way or other, because my whole purpose is try to get all the way out of here. So for some people that who this is the only out is, you know, life without, I don't have nothing against that, but that's not what I'm striving for. But the people who that's their only shot, you know, I feel that they should get that, if that's what's all they could get.
So if you were voting, how would you vote?
I would vote for any death penalty, because I wouldn't put this on my worst enemy or anybody, because in the same token, you have a whole bunch of people that every day they turn around and find out this person's innocent through DNA and stuff. So if you can't really say that this person did it or not, then you're going to kill a person. You can't come back from that.
So you would vote to change it to life without?
Yeah. I don't see, you know, playing God to have anybody get killed. So you got to understand, they ain't killing nobody. It's just racking up more and more money. And, you know, it canceling schools, medical programs for the handicapped people. I mean, this definitely is not doing nobody no good.
Mm.
I mean, I look at it like this. If you closing schools, then you're going to have people commit crimes because they're not going to have no education. So it's like, you know, it's defeating the whole purpose.
But at the same time, if they do change to the life without parole, if the voters pass that initiative, then some of that money that's paying for your appeal would be given to the schools.
Yeah.
That's theoretical.
Yeah.
But, I mean, do you think you would support that?
Yeah. It's, I mean,
even if it means you would lose.
Yeah. Kids need education. I mean, I don't want to see nobody here.
We continue on and stop at Demetrius Howard's cell. A jury convicted Howard for the 1992 murder of a woman in San Bernardino. Inside his cell, Howard has covered the fluorescent light with colored paper, giving the dark space a warm glow. He's also turned the surface of his bed into a desk, and today it's covered with some pencil sketches he's been working on. Something emanating from the cell smells sweet.
Wow, you have nice incense. Is that incense?
No, it's just oil for a body of prayer.
Oh, that's nice.
You know, you can't let yourself lose your sense of, you know, your spiritualness and staying clean and staying fresh and keeping your spirit vibrant and your
mind
vibrant.
And that's how you do it with?
Yeah, you know, that's just part of
essential oils.
Yeah.
How do you
just
get them?
We allowed to order them. You know, they allow us to order them through our religious, different religious you know, programs they have set up. So it's just, you know, something to keep you still connected to the world where, you know, because you're in an environment where you're closed in and, you know, scents and all kind of variety of scents, you know what I mean? So it's good to help you keep balance. And so, yeah.
How long have you been here?
I've been here 17 years.
Have you always been in East Block?
No, I've been back and forth to the Adjustment Center over the years, but I've been in East Block primarily majority of my time.
So how does Adjustment Center compare to East Block?
Oh, it compares very different. More freedoms over here, you know, like phone calls, contact with your family, being able to have a variety of, like, hobby programs, being able to hobby shop where you are, you know, to draw. It's just, you know, better going out to the yard daily. You know what I mean? You didn't have a contact visit with your attorneys and family. It's a big difference, you know, to your mind, your spirit.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, and Australia. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to a report by KALW's Nancy Mullane from inside California's death row, as she asks Demetrius Howard about Proposition 34, the 2012 ballot measure that would have replaced the death penalty with life without the possibility of parole. Californians rejected the measure in November 2012 by just 5% of the vote.
How are you feeling about the initiative that's up before the voters in November? The one that would change death sentences to life without parole?
I'm constantly fighting for my freedom. You know what I mean? My innocence.
Feel you're innocent?
Well, I know I'm innocent, and I know I feel it's something that's factual.
The appeals process, Howard says, is slow, tedious, and strenuous, but he remains confident that eventually he will be found innocent. And if Proposition 34 passes...
I don't feel it's to a lot of individuals' benefit, because then they'll be out, you know, without attorneys and being able to really address the issues of being innocent and wrongly convicted. So it would be devastating in a lot of ways.
To go to life without?
Yeah, because, I mean, many of us have been here over decades, and that in itself is already a life sentence. It's already a life sentence just being here for many years. So to go to another situation of life sentence...
But you'd have more freedoms. You'd be out in Main Yard, you'd be walking the yard, you'd see the trees, you'd see the sky and the moon.
Yeah, but, I mean, you're still incarcerated. For me to compute it in my mind, because of my certain situation, that's like not even acceptable. You know what I mean? My goals and objective is beyond these walls, period. But I'm curious and interested to see what's going to happen about the voters, because I know that the death penalty is political.
As we reach the farthest end of the tier, I notice a pink sign is attached to the gate of the last cell. It identifies the inmate as visually impaired. His name is Justin Helzer. 7 years ago, he was convicted and sentenced to death for the murder of 5 people, including the daughter of guitarist Elvin Bishop.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I have a lot of medical problems.
Oh, I see. Okay. I'm just doing a story about the conditions on death row.
Okay.
How do you feel about the conditions on death row?
Speaking from a medical standpoint, it's hard to see the doctor. For instance, I can only see the doctor once every 2 or 3 months, unless it's a visible problem. Then the nurse will schedule an appointment to see the doctor prior to my scheduled rotation.
How long have you been here?
I've been here since 2005, but I was arrested since 2000. I was fighting my case in county jail for 5 years.
Are you guilty?
Yes, yes, I kill people. Yes, I did.
You did kill people?
Yes, I killed 2 people. Point is I'm not. I wrote a letter of apology to the family members of the deceased. I apologized. It was erroneous. It was so misdirected. I'm so sorry. And I'm just, it's like another past life. I'm not that person anymore. And so I don't have a problem admitting what I did. I've taken responsibility for it. I'm not proud of it. To say it was a mistake was a huge understatement. I can't express how sorry I am. It was so unnecessary. But I don't want to talk about a case.
Okay. So you have vision impaired? You're a vision...
I'm totally blind. What it was a suicide attempt. I stuck two 5-inch pens into my brain through my eye sockets. It didn't kill me.
When did you do that?
About a year and a half ago.
Oh, I see.
And so it left me blind and partially paralyzed. I'm 100% blind.
But you were, before that, you were fine?
I had perfect vision. I was fine. I had vision, yes.
Oh, so...
I'm just tired of death row. It was a failed suicide attempt. And so I'm left with paralysis, partial paralysis, and complete blindness, which is, they call, vision impaired. So that's me.
How do you feel now that you're you've done that, and now you're living...
Terrible. I'm terrible. I'm not interested in committing suicide anymore. Like I said, that was a year and a half ago. I've embraced my situation. I'm more okay with the way things are now. I've learned to accept things the way things are. So, but the conditions on death row are such that it can lead one to attempt to commit suicide or attempt to do whatever. They're not good here. And
how does it compare not having sight to having sight on death row?
Well, sight was much better.
Unlike the other cells I visited, aside from some packaged food and a few clothes, Helzer's cell is void of personal effects. While we talk, he sits on the edge of his bunk and turns his face toward the cell door. I ask him for his thoughts on Prop 34.
I think it's the next step of as society wakes up and realizes this here is so unnecessary. It's all politics. It's politics, and right now the people are buying into the political story. Oh, death row, tough on crime. It's not a deterrent. Death penalty is not a deterrent. Because I'll tell you why. One is, when people do commit crimes, they are not thinking, "Oh my gosh, I might get the death penalty. I better not do this." They're in the moment. They want what they want. They have short-sighted. They don't foresee the consequences of their actions, and they do because they're impulsive. They do whatever they do, whatever crime it is, not thinking about the ramifications. So the notion that the death penalty is somehow a deterrent is a false premise. It's what people want to be true, not true.
What if people say they want the death penalty just because they want people to be punished?
Let me tell you. You can punish people plenty by giving them LWOP. Besides, there are people here on death row 30, 40 years, and they haven't gotten killed. And they have so many more appeals left to them. So no one's getting killed. No one's getting executed.
How do you see the rest of your life?
I don't know. I just take one day at a time. Just one day at a time.
That was a report by Nancy Mullane of KLW from San Quentin's death row. She was speaking with death row prisoners before the November 2012 vote on Proposition 34, which would have replaced the death penalty with life without the possibility of parole. Still with us is Professor David Dow of the University of Houston and Christine Thomas of the Campaign to End the Death Penalty. Professor David Dow, I'm wondering if you can put this in a national context for us. We've been hearing from California, but is the death penalty being replaced with life without the possibility of parole in other states too?
I do think that one of the factors that has driven down the number of new death sentences in most states is the availability of life without parole. We didn't really have life without parole a generation ago in the United States, or strictly speaking, we did, but it was reserved for a very, very, very small number of crimes. And over the last generation, the use of life without parole has really exploded. Nationwide, there are over 40,000 prisoners who are serving sentences of life without parole. And of course, what that means is that you're going to have people in prison who are 65, 70, 75 years old, and they're not, for all intents and purposes, capable of even committing the kind of crimes that most scare people in society. And in many cases, they're going to be dependent on medical care. I have a client on death row in Texas who is 73 years old, and he's confined to a wheelchair. And when I go see him, he has to be brought out in a wheelchair, and he's carrying an oxygen canister in his lap. And what we've done by embracing so vigorously life without parole is we've created literally thousands and thousands and thousands of such inmates. So it's a paradox, because I think that on the one hand, the availability of life without parole has in fact driven down the number of new death sentences. The truth of the matter is that life without parole suffers from the same essential moral failure that the death penalty suffers from. The reason that the death penalty is immoral is it might be immoral for a wide variety of reasons, but certainly one of the reasons that it's immoral is that it assumes that people who commit murder are rabid animals, that they lack all humanity, that they are not capable of remorse, that they are not capable of change, that they're not capable of improvement. And, of course, sentencing somebody to life without parole makes that exact same set of assumptions. And so that's why I myself, as a death penalty opponent, was quite satisfied to see California voters reject it. And I realized it was rejected by people for very different reasons, and some of those reasons I disagree with emphatically. But I think that one of the factors that contributed to its defeat is that there are quite a number of Californians like Christine who said, we're against the death penalty, but we are not so against the death penalty that we're willing to sacrifice our moral cores in order to move an additional 700 men off of death row and confine them to prisons for the rest of their lives.
And a question to you and Christine Thomas. Some opponents of the death penalty in California said that this was a way to shift the debate about the death penalty, and that once the death penalty was off the books, then they could focus on life without the possibility of parole. What do you say to that?
The people in California who wrote to me and told me that they were against life without parole, but they thought that they would vote for this anyway, and then later on they would fight that battle, I thought to myself, this is just the greatest exhibition of naivety that I've ever seen. Unlike the death penalty, which is in its last throes and is about to die, life without parole isn't in its last throes at all. Life without parole is in many respects really just taking off in America. And so it might be true that their next effort is going to be to defeat this measure that they have just thrown their weight behind. But that defeat is not going to occur for another generation. And I just think that that's too big of a sacrifice to make. So I do, in fact, think that one day in the United States we'll abandon life without parole too. But I don't think that that's going to happen for another generation. And so I think that it's just too big of a sacrifice to have embraced in this context.
I agree with David 100%. And I think I see it sort of like an inoperable tumor. All revenge sentencing, 250 to life, 100 to life, 60 to life, life without parole, juvenile, LWOP, the death penalty. You either believe in redemption or you don't. You either push to get rid of all of that kind of sentencing and you say, you know what, we're actually paying in California about $50,000 a year, a whole lot more for the death penalty, but for general mainline prisons, about $50,000 a year scholarships forever. If you're willing to pay for that for people in prison, then we should really be willing to look at what it takes to deter crime in the first place, what it takes to stop kids from going to prison in the first place. And we ought to be able to look at how we do that, how we stop crime, how we stop victims, if we really care about victims, how we stop victims from ever even occurring. We could do it a lot less expensively. We would really be caring. You either have redemption or you don't. Revenge sentencing is a failure.
Christine Thomas and David Dow, thank you for speaking with Making Contact. And that's all we've got time for on this edition. Special thanks to Nancy Mullane and KALW. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.